This show is provided for entertainment and informational purposes only. It should not be relied upon as legal, business, investment, or tax advice. Neither the hosts, guests, nor any funds they may manage intends to make an offer or solicitation for the sale or purchase of any specific securities, investments, or investment strategies.
Please, speak as you might to a young child or a golden retriever.
It's an unfair game.
They're schemers. Schemers trying to control their little worlds.
Rich get richer, that's the law of the land.
It's just money.
Blasphemy! This is madness!
I drink your milkshake!
Hey everyone, welcome back to another episode of Milkshakes, Markets, Madness. We talk about financial markets. The madness piece has a little bit to do with the markets, a little bit to do with real life, a lot to do with Twitter. And the milkshakes part, if you're unfamiliar with what we're referring with that, please visit our website, milkshakespod.com. We break it all down there. It is a bit of a theme here, but it is also a bit of a narrative explaining some of the financial systems. So you can get your answers there on the website. My name is John Kutzmita, and I'm joined here with Brent Johnson. Brent, happy, we won't disclose what day of the week it is, but how are you?
I'm good. How about you?
Good, man. So look, we've been on kind of a pattern of talking about violently sideways, and it doesn't seem like we're going to escape that anytime soon. Ironically, we're both wearing red, which was somewhat accidental, actually completely accidental. So it seems somewhat fitting given the chop and up and down that we're experiencing, particularly in the bond market. You know, the 10-year treasury is now back over 4%. For a very long time, the narrative has been that the Fed uses very lagging indicators when making monetary policy. They've already hiked too far. And now we're getting an endless stream of sticky inflation data where it doesn't seem like what they're doing is really fixing anything. And like I said, the narrative for a very long time is, well, these are lagging indicators. These are lagging indicators. How much longer are these things going to lag before they become reality? Or has the plot changed and people just aren't picking up on it?
Well, I think that's kind of the million-dollar question right there. You know, the markets have kind of what we've, as you mentioned, have dubbed violently sideways because I think it's a battle of narratives right now. There's the narrative that things are actually going to get better. Rates are going to come down. The Fed is going to go back to easing. And so you need to be long risk assets. That's one narrative. The other narrative is that these rate hikes are going to cause an immense amount of damage in the economy. It's just a matter of time. And, you know, anybody who stands in the way of Jay Powell and trying to bring down inflation by a crushing demand is asking for trouble. And so that's kind of where we are. And, you know, it's really kind of interesting to see every day, either on Twitter or social media or on Bloomberg or, you know, CNBC, you know, both sides kind of, you know, making their case. And as soon as there's one data point that supports somebody's case, man, they're pounding the table on that. And then another point will come out that supports the other side, and man, they'll pound the table on that. And meanwhile, you know, here we are. We're just, again, this violently sideways. And I really don't think there's going to be much, much clarity before the Fed meeting. You know, maybe we will. I mean, you always have to be ready for it. But my guess is that we'll probably get into the Fed meeting, which is, I think, a couple of weeks away now, before we get any clarity. And it's kind of silly that in a global marketplace, you have to sit and wait for what a couple of people are going to say. But unfortunately, you know, that's where we're at.
Yeah. And we've talked about before, somewhat recently, the fact that, you know, they've become celebrities in their own way and that markets have kind of played right into the palm of their hand as far as their power of jawboning markets in certain directions. But, you know, we've had the Fed particularly has been given a dual mandate, maximum employment, which we've really had for a very long time. And if you take out COVID and everything that happened during lockdowns, we've been somewhat in a stable employment environment. And I don't think it's efficient to go into the the data right now as far as employment, because there are gaps and questions about, you know, is the labor market as tight as it is? But the other side of that dual mandate is price stability. And clearly they have screwed that up when you have 40-year high inflation. So they are going to be damn sure that they get this right. And so far, it doesn't seem like they're having as much success as they would have liked cooling inflation when you see some of the data that's come out here in the U.S. And then we've also talked about in previous episodes where it's very unlikely that anyone is, any central bank is making a decision independently. And so when you start to see inflation data come out in the Europe markets overseas, and it's even hotter, it doesn't feel like that, you know, they're going to stop hiking anytime soon. And so one of the things that you mentioned before and is worth bringing up again here is this idea that the higher rates, we've gotten to a point now where they're actually stimulative. And so does the Fed eventually get themselves into a position where they're kind of chasing their tail? Or is it exactly what they want, the Goldilocks, where they can then just pause and kind of let these high rates give them that 2%, maybe slightly higher, 3% inflation annually without having to do this like boom bust cycle that they're so, you know, prone to?
Yeah, well, you know, it's such an interesting topic to me for so many reasons. The one thing that I find pretty interesting, and I always do my, I'm sure I fail at this, but I always do my best to kind of try to remain objective, right? And I've been a huge central bank and Fed critic for just about as long as I can remember, certainly the last 10 or 15 years. That said, so far, like if I'm in the camp that, you know, central banks need to exist and they play a very important role and all of that, and you just look back and objectively see what Powell has done, let's not during COVID and letting rates go too high or rates stay too low for too long, but since then, since the hiking cycle, he has done a pretty good job, or the markets have responded in a much better way than almost anybody expected. I mean, he's hiked rates 5 or 6 times. We're close to 4.5-5%. I don't know anybody that thought that he could do that in less than a year without having grave consequences. Now, I think we all agree that at some point there will be grave consequences, but at some point, but so far there haven't been. And I think part of the reason, and this is what's leading to some of the debate, and it's part of the debate that I even have with myself, is that while asset prices have come down, but they haven't crashed, but commodity prices, you know, for the most part have come down. You know, oil's in the 70s, natural gas is under $3. You know, corn, wheat, copper, lumber, all of the, if you look at a chart from the last 10 years, last 15 years, all of these commodities are about where they were 10 or 15 years ago. So there hasn't been this massive commodity inflation. Now, I'm not going to say groceries are more expensive. Food is more expensive. So I'm not saying that this isn't affecting Main Street. I'm just saying if you just look at asset prices or these commodity prices, they've come down a lot over the last year. But what has remained very sticky and even, you know, increased is, to your point earlier, labor costs. And I think that has a little bit to do with the bigger structural issues, people retiring and just not coming back into the workplace. And therefore, you have a shortage. And the big question for me is, how long does that last? Right. And the thing is until we have a issue in the banking system and there's a big credit contraction and there is this big downturn in assets, I feel like those wages can stay pretty sticky because those people won't need to come back into the workforce, right? And so, to your point, you get into this yin and this yang and this tailwind that the higher rates now have. And you touched on this a minute ago, and I think I'm getting in on a little bit of a rant here, but I think it's important for people to think about this, especially for kind of the retail person who's doing their best to kind of take care of their nest egg and maybe isn't, you know, deep in the markets every day. The common narrative is that these higher rates are bad for stock prices, are bad for asset prices, and it's going to cause a recession. That is the common refrain. The reality is if you look back throughout history, when equity prices are rising, it's usually alongside interest rates rising. You know, this idea that rising interest rates always cause markets to crash is not correct. Now, they eventually do, but they don't do it right away. And the other thing is that, you know, for years and years and years, the criticism of central banks was they are keeping interest rates low. Savers cannot make any money. They're not getting any return on the fruits of their labor. Now they're getting criticized because they're jacking rates up too fast and too much. But the reality is this is the point that I want to make. Until we get this crisis, until we get this credit contraction and growth actually stops and reverses, the rate hikes are a tailwind because the Treasury is spending more money on bills, on bonds, on, you know, 2-year, 3-year, 5-year, 10-year notes. Somebody owns those. And when they have to pay a higher interest rate, that money is going into their accounts. And so the saver who just a year ago or a few years ago had to go way out on the risk return curve in order to get 1 or 2% can now sit in 6-month T-bills and get 4% or 4.5%. I just bought a bunch of T-bills for a client the other day. They exited an asset. They had the cash. They were like, well, what do we do? I said, I mean, just put it in T-bills. You get 4.5% and we get a weight and we get all this optionality. And that's a massive, massive change from even just a year ago, a massive change. And so, you know, that, and I think the fact that this money is getting put into people's accounts is part of the thing that's causing this violently sideways.
Yeah. So if you're in the last couple of years, really for quite a while, as interest rates have declined in the bond market and just in, you know, overnight policy rates, there has been that lack of yield. And when this experiment really first started after the GFC, after 2009, it was an experiment. And once we had a bit of data and we could pull ourselves back and look at it, we realized that, and it's not just post-crisis, like over 35 years, we now have that data set that higher rates actually stimulate growth, stimulate the economy, and stimulate credit growth. And the idea that it's more of the stimulus and the liquidity that eventually drives over speculation. And that's where then the Fed comes in too early or too late. Right. They're just trying to be too particular with the knobs. And, you know, when you're looking at something like optionality, you would know better than me, but you haven't really had an environment like this where normally with optionality, you actually have time decay, right? You lose money waiting for the payout. You're kind of putting on an insurance policy, yep, so to speak. Now you're actually getting paid for optionality, right? Your first thing came to my mind when you're talking about someone exiting a position. It's like, well, what do you do? Well, you get paid to wait. That's not even a hard decision, right? So even if it's 3 months, but the average retail person's not making the velocity of trades aren't that high. So to go buy a 12-month, you know, T-bill and get paid 4% to see how this plays out is a very, very interesting shift in the marketplace. Yeah. And as far as your attitude towards central bankers, let's advise everybody here that your Twitter handle is Santiago AU Fund. So you embarked on an entire journey of like, how do you hedge in gold for the end of the universe? And you have a much more, you know, balanced view on how this plays out. And you've really become comfortable with the idea that you don't know how this plays out. And therefore, you have to be positioned for just about anything. And you kind of referenced that in a recent tweet thread. And one of the things I want you to talk about that thread, but one of the things I want perhaps you to articulate a little bit more is there something specific or particular at this time that makes the current environment so much more difficult than anyone that you've ever been in? And I'll lay it up for you. The tweet thread that you had dropped, and you can fill in some of the blanks here, was basically saying that this is the most difficult environment you've ever traded in, and the outcomes are more uncertain than they've ever been for you.
Yeah, I know. And I think the reason it's so difficult now is because there are so many risks that are so obvious, right? And we've talked about the fact that when everybody sees the risk, it might not happen. But there's a flip side too. You know, if we're sitting at a resort, at a mountain resort, having just skied, and we look up on the mountain and we see an avalanche coming down towards us, and everybody else sees it too, just because everybody else sees it doesn't mean it doesn't provide any risk, right? You still have to take it seriously. So, the, you know, all of these risks that people very rightly point out, whether it's due to the military conflict with Russia and Ukraine, whether it's to the heightened tensions between China and the United States, whether it's due to the oil and energy problems that we have in Europe and in the United States, you know, or whether it's the higher rates are going to cause, you know, a commercial real estate crash. All of these are very legitimate concerns. You absolutely have to take them into consideration and be ready for them. The flip side is what we've just been talking about. They haven't materialized in the markets yet. And while they haven't materialized in the markets, markets have been holding up pretty well. And people that are in the money market are making money. And, you know, I can't say for sure that those risks that I very clearly see are going to materialize this year. So what do you do in the meantime, right? And it's kind of nice now to have that optionality that we were just talking about. It's not a horrible thing to kind of sit on the sidelines, get paid an actual decent yield while you're waiting to see. But kind of related to this, the other side of the story is, you know, the other narrative that we talked about. For years and years and years, loan growth was very small. And everybody would always talk about how much money the Fed was printing. Well, the real printing in an economy takes place by the banks. When banks lend, they are creating money out of thin air. And that's where the majority of money in the system comes from. And a lot of people said, well, when the Fed starts raising rates, nobody's going to borrow because they're not going to be able to afford it. Well, actually, over the last year, there's been more loan growth than there was in the previous, I don't know, several years. So you've actually seen loan growth over the last year. That means there's new, not only are people getting paid a higher rate on the money they already have in savings, but there's new money being created in the form of loans. And then let's take the other side of it. Let's pretend you own a trucking company and you're based in the Midwest. Let's say you're based in Kansas City and you got five competitors and it's been tough to hire people because, you know, the wage growth and the wage pressure that we've talked about. And, you know, last year you didn't take out and there was a lot of uncertainty. You know, the economy was down last year, so you didn't take out a loan and buy five new trucks in order to expand your business, but your competitor did. And so now, you know, you're kind of behind the eight ball. He's already got his fleet of trucks. He's making money. You're trying to keep up, but now it's even more expensive for you to take out that loan than it was a year ago. Do you take out the loan now or do you wait? You know, you're behind the eight ball. You know, if you're going to compete with that guy, you need five more trucks. And so that's an environment. And I would argue that's kind of happened to a certain extent over the last year. You know, when you're on the sidelines and everybody else is not, and they've already got the funds and you don't, and you want to stay in that industry, you've got to raise the money. So do you pay, I don't know, 8 or 9% now so that you don't have to pay 10 or 11% next year? Or do you wait? And this is the big battle. But I think it's really interesting to note that these higher rates have not yet caused lending to crash. And in fact, lending has picked up. And it's all of these different factors, all these different narratives that are kind of smashing into each other, which makes it incredibly difficult right now. I, for one, am extremely thankful that rates have risen, because it gives you that optionality to.
Yeah, and you're a lot of, excuse me, a lot of times people are looking at inflation in a static way. And we're now coming up, you know, June of last year was the peak CPI at over 9% year over year from the prior year. So now we're getting to a point where from a rate of change basis, we're going to start to see more of a, again, you're comparing what inflation's really doing or how it erodes the principal value of your money versus a 4% T-bill. But the simple point I'm pushing back on is inflation really 7% at this point? So, and if you really want to get particular, go buy, I guess, tips or something of that nature. there's more to it than just comparing yield and you know, the cost decay. It's like we're saying, it's you're now actually getting paid to wait. One of the things I want to point out here is you are being very objective about this, but there is still this underlying notion that it has to crash because it's crashed before, and that this thing is coming, and you use the avalanche narrative. And I think what's going to happen if we really do have the early stages of an avalanche is I don't think anyone's going to wait to see how bad the avalanche is going to be. They're all going to run for the exits. All right, Brett. Well, look, welcome back. We had a quick little technical glitch, but what I had just said to you is the idea of that, pushing back a little bit on this notion that certain things have to happen, and that you had used an analogy of, around an avalanche. And I had said that, you know, if this avalanche was actually occurring, I think no one's going to really stand around to watch it because everyone's been expecting or waiting for it, and really has a feeling this is going to be the mega avalanche. I would say that, to tweak the analogy a little bit, I feel like we're more in an environment where the average person's looking up on the mountain and just sees a nice, friendly, snowy peak. And everyone who's an expert on snow and avalanches is looking at it and saying, well, there's no trees, and that snow bank has been there for a while, and the sun is 2 degrees warmer than it normally is, and all these factors, like, oh, an avalanche has to come, an avalanche is coming. And you had pointed out in a previous episode how important it is to recall that markets trade on expectations, not absolute value. And so markets are down, or were down, because their expectations were the Fed was going to raise and all these bad things were going to happen. So maybe some of those losses have already been written. That story has been told. And maybe this is just a slow, you know, snow melt. And, you know, we have a fresh new spring, and everybody's lived to tell another, you know, to see another day.
Yeah. I mean, this is the thing. I mean, I know there's a lot of people out there right now shaking their head. There's no, this is, don't be stupid. This has to happen. Right. Mm-hmm. And the thing is, inevitably it does. But we've talked about this so many times, inevitable and imminent are two completely different things. And while this will certainly end badly at some point, I don't know that it's going to be in the next 6 months. I think it is. I don't think we're going to have the major, you know, depressionary crash in the next 6 months, like some people think. I do think we're going to have a correction. I do think that this is going to be an extremely tough year. I think the easy money has already been made. I think it's really, really difficult from here on out. But I don't know for sure. And I'm not going to bet everything on any one narrative. I think you got to be ready for it all. This goes back to why it's so challenging. There are a number of headwinds that I think a lot of people see, but there's a lot of tailwinds that I don't think people are quite aware of. And that's what we've tried to talk about a little bit today, is that there are some tailwinds and there are some things that could make this last a little longer than you think. And you know, I kind of say this all the time, but I you know, keep your mind open and keep reading and keep listening to people, and don't have a closed mindset. That's what we used to, you know, when my son was going to, when he was younger in school, that was like the words they used. Keep a growth mindset. Don't be shut off to anything. And I think it's really appropriate now. You know, growth mindset, being open to new ideas, is probably more important now than ever before.
Well, and you were just talking about you're giving another analogy about this trucking company and hiring people. The Fed's job is not to boost asset prices. And we've kind of gotten, again, kind of gaslit into thinking that that's their responsibility. And, you know, and during Trump's presidency, he kind of became his own market jawboner, right? He was kind of pushing and feeding that animal spirit that pushed the markets higher. But that's not really, I mean, you think about it, again, going back to this expectations versus absolute or nominal value, businesses don't operate their business that way. Yes, they'll make capital expenditure and invest in their business based on future growth plans, but there's more of a constant monitoring of P&L and profit and loss and what's going on in terms of gross revenue and how to operate their business. And the reason I mention this is because, again, kind of playing this devil's advocate of a crash has to happen. And I'm not saying that the Fed knows what they're doing. I'm in the same ballpark that these guys are complete sociopaths and you know, up to their neck in hubris, and they're going to blow this up at one point. But the idea potentially of, or at least to play this devil's advocate narrative of, maybe they hit the Goldilocks, right? We've felt some of the pain. You mentioned earlier, all these asset prices have done a full 180. They're back to pre-COVID, pre-stimulus. And the thing that is actually now kind of humming along is the real economy, potentially, right? That's the debate we're proposing here. And that these businesses are now making investment decisions because they have to, because maybe the labor market's tight, and because that's what competition causes you to do. You take risk. So it's one of those things to really keep a close eye on, is maybe asset prices go violently sideways for a really long time, and this becomes the age of, dare I say, the value investor.
It could. You got to be open to it. You got to kind of be, again, it's so hard. It's so easy to jump into one camp and say, well, this has to be deflationary, or it has to be inflationary, or you have to buy gold, or you have to buy crypto, or you have to buy the dollar, or you have to buy commodities, or whatever it is. And the thing is, you don't have to do any one thing. So don't.
Well, I know we're going a little long here, but I think, you know, we're at a point where there's not real specific things to dig into any deeper, because we are in this sideways pattern. So I think it's good to kind of have more of this macro conversation. So one of the last things I want to kind of put on your plate before we wrap up here is this idea of liquidity. You know, liquidity is really only going to come from commercial banks lending. But, and you're saying, hey, loan growth is at a healthy tick. You know, look what we had last year. But then everyone's flashing these charts of M2 and the money supply and how, you know, it's collapsed, or the velocity of money has collapsed as well. And that's a big component. And if people are taking out loans and then just sitting on a credit line in their bank account, is that really stimulative? But in addition to that, we still have this debt ceiling situation going on, and therefore that doesn't really suck up or drain that liquidity either. And instead, the Treasury is actually pushing more of it out.
Yeah. So you think about it, the Treasury, the Fed kind of makes the decisions, but the Treasury then, you know, has to deal with the interest rates that the Fed sets. When we're up against the debt ceiling, the Treasury cannot issue debt at the same level or at the same speed that they would like to. Normally, when there's not a debt ceiling, they can issue bonds. And when they issue bonds, they're trading bonds for money. So they're sending bonds out into the market and they're taking money out of the market. So when they're taking money out of the market, they're draining that liquidity from the market. Now, they're going to turn around and spend it pretty quickly, so it doesn't get drained for long, but there is at least a temporary drain. Now, right when you're up against the debt ceiling, that drain doesn't happen. But the government is still spending money. And not only are they spending the money from just their typical budget out of their bank account, but they're having to spend even more on interest payments. But those interest payments are going into the market. And so you get this flow of liquidity. You get kind of a tailwind until this all gets resolved. And again, that's another one of these, you know, a tailwind that maybe those who are watching interest rates rise and markets, you know, the Fed do monetary tightening, are not aware of. And this has been written about a little bit since kind of October, November timeframe, is that the Yellen's Treasury policies are kind of offsetting, you know, Powell's, you know, monetary policies. And I would say on net, it has probably been flat and, you know, neutral to even loosening a little bit over the last 4 or 5 months. And I think the Fed has been okay with that because inflation has started to come down. Now, if that happens to reverse, or if it doesn't come down as quick as they would like, that's when it's going to get very, very interesting. I mean, extremely interesting. I mean, this is really kind of the Super Bowl. Like, if you like markets and you like macro and you like trying to figure out this crazy, ridiculous, maddening puzzle, I mean, this is about as good as it gets.
Yeah, it's still a little early for you to be mentioning the Super Bowl. There's still some
such a great win for the Chiefs. Such a great win. Great game.
I'm not too happy about wearing red while you mention it. So awesome, man. I appreciate, you know, that you'd go along for that journey and dig a little deeper into some of these macro themes. I think this this is the argument. This is the Super Bowl, like you're saying. There's so many of these things that are tugging, and I think a lot of people are still playing the same playbook instead of coming up with something unique like the Philly special. So I was able to sneak that in.
Nice job.
All right. Yeah, you got it. So, Brent, thanks, man. We'll look to see how some of this plays out over the next week. It seems like it's going to take a little longer than a week, but we'll be here in a couple, in about 7 days to rehash what's happened. For this episode, I think it's been a good one. You can follow Brent Johnson on Twitter at SantiagoAUFund. You can follow me at John Katsumita. You can do whatever you'd like with the podcast as far as engaging with us on YouTube or Twitter, all under the same handle at Milkshakes Pod. And you can find more information about what the heck Milkshakes is all about, the Dollar Milkshake Theory, at milkshakespod.com. So thanks again, Brent. I appreciate you, and we'll see you next week.
All right, man. Have a great one.
You too.